It's the Fun Driver edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, the Ukraine is at the start of World War III. Some other really interesting stuff, but most importantly, we have returning host emeritus Ethan Clow to help us discuss fiction, fantasy, and skepticism. And don't forget, it's the Fun Drive edition, so pull out your wallets. Let's begin episode 245.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and we're back with the beginning of our show, Radio Free Thinker, the Fun Drive Fantasy Edition, for those who might have missed it when the music was playing and I was talking, and yay for public radio. Joining me today is Ethan Clow. Say hello, Clow.
Hello, everybody. Did you miss me?
I missed you, yes, yes. We missed you muchly. But we missed more Daniel, who we have to give out a big thanks. Daniel just gave $1,000 to the pledge drive here at CITR. So a much welcome word and shout out to Daniel for donating so much. Every dollar counts to keep alternative radio such as this alive and keeping shows like ours, which I know everyone out there loves so much. So, Ethan, what's new in your world?
Oh, well, I mean, Don, I have been just incredibly busy, but great to be back here. I mean, I've been listening. Can't say that I like the show without me on it. But
you like the show, just not as much.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's pretty good. Let's be honest. It's okay. It's not bad, you know.
Okay. Well, you know, and with any luck, I mean, besides the pledge drive that's going on right now, is, well, you know, the world might end soon. I don't know if you've been listening to the news at all, but in the Ukraine, we have some good old-fashioned Cold War, let's bring in the tanks kind of, I don't know, brinksmanship? Have you been following that at all?
Yeah, well, I believe you're referring to the crisis in the Ukraine.
Crisis in Crimea.
Yeah,
Crimea.
That's... Yeah.
So, anyhow, so I thought we'd start off the show by talking a little bit about what the hell's going on in the Ukraine and what's going on. The road to revolution in Ukraine started in Kiev in November when their prime minister, Yanukovych, pulled out of a free trade deal with the European Union, opting instead for a $15 billion deal with Russia, which offered him aid and cheap gas. The ousted leader, who actually disappeared for a couple weeks and has just recently turned up in Russia, surprise, surprise, Yanukovych also is pursuing closer ties with Putin's custom unions with Kazakhstan and Belarus. He's now actually the technical excuse for the Russian sort of invasion of the Crimea. They're saying that Yanukovych actually asked for the intervention. So it's important to note, though, that this event isn't from out of nowhere. Putin's been warning the U.S. and other North America, and the U.S. and NATO, that about 6 years ago, that, you know, don't interfere in our sort of zone of influence. You can do little things, but not big things. And in particular, in the Ukraine, in particular, again, the Crimea, where Russia actually has its black fleet. And it's been there since 1783, after the Ottomans seceded the peninsula. Putin told a closed NATO summit in Romania in 2008 that the military alliance was threatening Ukraine's very existence by courting it as a member. There was a lot of talk at one point to have Ukraine join NATO. Ukraine liked it because it had lived through the Soviet years where tanks would roll in if you did anything that wasn't. Let's remember Prague Spring and Hungary where they did that sort of thing. And Putin made a comment that Ukraine's borders are sewn together after World War II. And he claims that, well, Crimea really does belong to Russia. It wasn't until Nikita Khrushchev in 1954 actually gave the Crimea to Ukraine. And so he basically says, listen, this is not really very kosher stuff to do. Putin backed up this sort of threat or willingness to put actions to words when he sent in Russian troops against Georgia when there were two sort of provinces that felt threatened and threatened succession. Russia came in and said, hey, these are now independent nations and we're protecting them. Basically, you know, one of the things that's coming into this too is that there's a lot, it's really interesting on the left because you have on the one side the sort of right-wing people saying, hey, look, at this is Soviet style, Putin has become the new czar. And then on the left, you have people saying, listen, this is another American attempt at undermining a democracy for their own geopolitical gains. And to be fair, both sides have been trying to play up the sort of ethnic tension part of it. You know, the Americans are sort of saying, Ukraine, you're an independent nation. Come join the European Union where you can be more free. And then you've got the Russians sitting there saying, listen, we're an oppressed people. It is important to note that the majority of people in the Crimea, what is it, 59%, are actually Russian, ethnic Russians. In the nation in total, they comprise, I think, about 17% of the entire Ukraine. Although if you add on to that Russian-speaking people as opposed to ethnic Russians, I think that number expands. And it's been pointed out that that it's just not the Crimea that's at stake here. There are several provinces in the eastern part of the nation who want closer ties to Russia. They feel more in tune with the Russian idea. And Russia may not just stop with the Crimea. It may actually go in and, quote, liberate these particular people. In fact, it was listening just to the news today where our own illustrious Minister Kenny was replying to someone and says, yes, but, you know, the majority of people in the Crimea are Russians. And he quipped out. He said, yes, and the majority of people in the Sudetenland were German, basically equating what Stalin, what Putin was doing with what Hitler was doing, sort of in this rolling takeover. Right now, actually, the Ukraine government saying that there's up to 16,000 troops in the Crimea, which is a small area, although they do have their huge fleet, and that the Russians are playing up, that Sevastopol is like the hero nation. Like, there's a lot of propaganda going on like this. So really, what can the West do about this? This is the other thing that's come in, right? I mean, I don't think you're going to have American troops come in there. Canadian troops, of course, would be laughed, although we do think we have a big influence, although it's probably more local politics that we're saying so much. But the biggest thing so far they've said is like, hey, we're going to not do the G8 thing this year, which was supposed to be happening in June in Sochi, and that seems like they're pulling back from that. Ironically enough, any sort of sanctions that they could put upon Russia are more likely to hurt the Europeans than the Russians, because one of the reasons why the Ukraine is so important to Russians' economic interest is a lot of their natural gas goes through there, but natural gas goes to Europe, which is heavily dependent on Russian gas. So Ethan, what do you make of that?
But the whole thing you just said?
No, let's start off with, do you think Russia actually has a viable claim to the Crimea?
Well, I mean, like you said, if every country said, hey, listen, the majority of our population in this region is ethnically or culturally us, we should control that area, you'd probably have a breakout of about 90,000 wars, give or take. So, I mean, in that respect, I don't know. I do think that the main issues that you mentioned there with regards to Russia and the Ukraine, one, the economic advantage. I mean, the Ukraine is basically the road that all the gas and oil goes through between Russia and Europe. You control Ukraine, you control a pretty important economic domino chip in Europe. Now, likewise, is any country, Britain, America, the powerful nations, so to speak, are any of them going to risk war with Russia? Probably not, because Russia has guns and an army. They'll pick on small nations, but not big ones. And that's probably a good thing, because the way to solve the situation is not going to be two powerful nations slugging it out. It's going to be economic debates, arguments, unfortunately, probably going to be argued in, you know, some smoke-filled back room somewhere in Putin's getaway cottage or whatever. But that's, I think, preferable than, you know, tanks and parachutes and bombs and machine guns.
Yeah, but don't we have sort of an asymmetric sort of battle going on here, because you are right. You know, the Brits, the Canadians, the Americans are not going to use boots on the ground. In fact, you know, with one or two rare exceptions, they don't do that sort of thing anymore, right? And I mean, they're okay. Iraq and Afghanistan are huge exceptions. But that being said, it's not quite the same sort of thing. But Russia does. Russia rolled in its troops into Azerbaijan. It rolled its troops into Chechnya. It rolled its troops into outer Ossetia. It's rolled troops into the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So it seems like Russia has no qualms about rolling troops in, at least locally. And you're right, the West pretty much doesn't. I mean, yeah, I guess if Mexico suddenly took over a part of Florida or some weird thing like that, the Americans would probably roll in troops, because these aren't quite the same things. But it is very asymmetrical in that sense.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And the fact that Russia is kind of in a weird position globally, politically, economically, power dynamics-wise, and in one sense, you can't really react to them in the same way you would react to, you know, say Spain invaded France or something. There'd be a different reaction. You could threaten France economically, whereas Russia, it's sort of like, what are you going to do? Take away our nothing? Like,
well, okay, so here's another aspect then about this that I think is kind of interesting. And I don't know how much of this has been blowing up. So some of it should be taken with a grain of salt. But it's, quote, third-hand sources pointed out that in a conversation between Angela Merkel and Putin, that Angela Merkel made the comment that Putin is living in a fantasy land. And if you think about it, again, one of these asymmetries of all the, quote, G8 or even G20 nations is Putin has pretty much become a dictator of Russia. I mean, they have democracy. Mm-hmm. It's not quite like the czarist regime. But at the same time, he does whatever he wants to do.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And in that sense, What if he is a little crazy? You know, he's just come off of the Sochi Olympics, which, by all marks, has been actually a glowing resolve. The fact that Russia won the most medals there has been really trumpeted up as in, hey, we can do anything we want.
By private judges.
Yes. Yeah. Well, hey, by whatever means it takes.
Yeah, there you go, right?
So do you think there's any risk to this sort of madman monarch?
Well, it's entirely possible. I mean, Putin should, I think, worry a lot of people in the West, a lot of the power brokers of the West. But again, it's sort of that problem is, you know, how do you realistically walk into someone else's country and be like, okay, I'm going to sort this out for you. And I mean, it's just sort of like you can't really... Well, I guess you could. But it's sort of hard to look yourself in the mirror, do it to Russia, and then complain when Russia does it to someone else.
Yeah, and actually, that was one of the funny things that Kerry apparently had just said, that, you know, the Russians invading the Ukraine without any justification. And everyone says, well, you do remember Iraq, right? I mean, you do kind of, I mean, were you there at the time kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, I think maybe we'll take a pause on...
Well, you know, Don, I think that since we're on the topic of moving and economics, it may be a good segue into CRTR's fund drive.
Yes.
Not that we're planning to invade the Ukraine. We're not.
No, but speaking of economic sanctions, haha, we would like to sanction you to donate money to CITR 101.9 FM. Now, if you do donate money, and there's lots of good reasons for it, but first of all, I'm going to say, hey, what's in it for you? Because everyone sadly sometimes think, what's in it for me? First of all, there's the swag. If you donate at the $30 level, you get the Friends of CIT card, which is basically discounts from various little shops around Vancouver and other areas. I think it's more than Vancouver now.
Yeah,
At the $60 level, you get the card, plus you get moving mug, which I assume is a mug that will get you moving, especially if you put in really strong coffee. At the 101.9 level, you get the Friends of CIT card, the Get Moving mug, and the Rad Socks, which we debated over a bit. We'll talk about that later. At the $175 mark, you get the card, you get the mug, you get the Rad Sock socks, and you get the CITR hoodie, which I don't wear in Florida because that could be dangerous.
Although I've seen the hoodie, and I have to say, it is one of the best hoodies I've ever seen in my life. And I normally don't say that about hoodies because, as everyone knows, I'm very particular about those sort of things. And I'm not just saying it because I have a show here, but it is a really nice hoodie.
What's so cool about it?
It's got a hood, and wow. It says CRTR on it, and it's black.
For those people really generous and they want to donate at the $250 mark, you get two friends cards, the sock, the rad sock, the hoodie, plus a T-shirt. And this is not a shirt that's shaped like a T. It's a full-on T-shirt. At the $500 mark, you get two friends cards, two mugs, two pairs of rad socks, the hoodie, and a T-shirt. At the $750, you get double everything. Everything we've mentioned, you get two of. If you donate at the $1,000 mark, and again, thank you, Daniel. You are one of these people who will get double everything. Plus, you will be put on a cassette tape on our donor's wall in the new sub that is rapidly coming to fruition to be here.
Yeah, you will be immortalized as part of CITR. And that's nothing to sniff at, because that is a big honor to be on our wall of honor.
It will be, and it's going to be in the new facilities, which just emphasizes that there's going to be things like moving costs, and there's going to be a bunch of other expenses that the station's going to have to do to move into our new digs. And for that, we need your help. We need you to donate. You can donate right now at 604-822-8648, or you can go to the website,
CITR.ca,
and donate there. Every amount counts. Yeah, I guess we're going to take a quick break so we can drink our coffee, take a bit of a deep breather, and then we may return, if I can figure things out, in a moment.
An independent radio station at odds against major broadcasting corporations.
I want CITR.
Dead.
I want CITR.
His family. Dead.
I want a radio station.
Burnt to the ground. I want to go to
Vancouver, BC.
I want to piss out his ashes.
Was given an opportunity they thought they would never get.
It's UBC. It says here that they want to give us a new radio station.
But they were up against one major problem.
How are we going to pay to move all our stuff into the new radio station?
CITR Radio presents the 2014 Fund Drive, a heartwarming story of compassion and generosity in which listeners like you donate to help support the station you love.
I just donated and it felt awesome.
For more information, go to www.citr.ca.
And we have returned. So, Ethan, we had a really nice conversation a little while ago about fiction, fantasy, or fantasy fiction, depending on how you want to word it, and skepticism. Now, refresh my memory. What were we talking about?
Well, we were debating, we were discussing the interesting role in sort of fantasy. And when I say fantasy, I mean I'm talking about things like The Hobbit, Game of Thrones, Lord of the Rings, or even, say, Star Trek, Star Wars, the books of Isaac Asimov or Arthur C. Clarke. What is their connection to the realm of skepticism? And I think that, Don, you will agree with me when I say this. It seems to be that a lot of skeptics are kind of abnormally obsessed with science fiction and fantasy. You might even call them nerds.
Yes. I think I dare say I don't think I know of a single one that has not read one of the sort of canons of the work. If you haven't read the Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, then you've done Star Trek. If you haven't done Star Trek, you've done the Foundation series. If you haven't done Foundation series, then you've done, I don't know, Fahrenheit 471, I think it is. It's yeah. not one of the big ones I have. But Ethan, okay. So we like fiction, and fiction does allow us to experiment, you know, sort of do thought experiments with the way things could be. But it struck me that when we were discussing this, that you were making a profound difference between fantasy fiction versus science fiction.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a contentious issue, I think. I've read a few quotes from famous authors like Isaac Asimov, who have sort of made the claim that science fiction is different from fantasy because science fiction could conceivably happen, whereas fantasy could not. And I actually don't think that's entirely true, because you look at some science fiction and it basically is fantasy. When you break the laws of physics,
right,
for the most part, I'm gonna call that not possible. So I think that fantasy and science fiction traditionally may be looked at as fantasy is sort of focused on the past, magic, make-believes, elves, dwarves, wizards. Science fiction is kind of focused on the future, space travel, and teleporters and laser guns and that sort of thing. But even that, I think, can be played around with, because, I mean, Star Wars is more fantasy than science fiction. It's got a wizard. It's got a Dark Lord. It's got magic swords and a princess and heroes and rogues and all these sorts of things. So the difference, I think, comes down to what is the motive, what is the central theme of the work. And for me, science fiction is often about exploring, you know, what it means to be human, what are we doing here, where are we going, by externalizing that question. So we explore what it means to be human by stitching a corpse together, Frankenstein's monster, you know. It's often considered the first science fiction work of all time. And fantasy is sort of, well, answer these big questions, but look inwards. Look at our, perhaps we want to call it a spiritual core or our internal strength. So, for example, Frodo in The Ring in Lord of the Rings, he travels through this ordeal by diving deep inside of himself and pulling out this inner strength that he didn't know that he had, that he actually did have all the time, and blah, 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 blah. It's more of a internal struggle. And I think that's one way of sort of looking at the difference between science fiction and fantasy, which I think is actually kind of opens an interesting question for skeptics, because we like to think of ourselves as sort of empirical people. We value reason and logic. And yet, at the same time, we gobble up these stories of magic and elves and wizards and sorcery.
Yeah. Well, and I think you've touched on a very interesting dichotomy, perhaps, is that fantasy fiction, as taken by Lord of the Rings type genres, is innately and inherently introspective. That is, you are reaching back into the past, be it a fictional past or a semi-fictional past, but it is going backwards. Whereas science fiction, by definition, is extroverted, that it is going forward into some possible, if impossible, sort of future. But how would you differentiate? So in the heart of, Star Trek, we'll use Star Trek only because it is less, there's very little fantasy sort of aspect in it. It's much more pure science, and everyone knows Star Trek. You have moral and ethical quandaries in there, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have moral and ethical quandaries in the Dragonlance books or the Lord of the Rings, to beat a dead horse. But how is the difference between fighting good and evil in Star Trek different than fighting good and evil in Lord of the Rings?
Well, I think one of the interesting aspects with Star Trek, specifically Star Trek, is that a lot of the, quote, evil in Star Trek is often a representation of a current threat. And I think this is sort of old hat for anyone who's ever thought about this, but in the original series, the Klingons were sort of the Soviet Russians. In the Next Generation, the Romulans were sort of kind of Chinese. They represented that sort of mysterious element that we didn't really understand. And I think that as that show progressed and the Borg sort of became more popular and then eventually was ruined by Star Trek Voyager, the Borg, I think, in some sense represented our fear of losing ourselves. And what bigger issue has been developing in, you know, the last 10 years with technology, but all of us plugged into our laptops. We have two of them on the table right now, not to mention a computer. I mean, it's a pretty extended metaphor in that sense. One of the things that's interesting about fantasy is when you fight like a dragon or a Dark Lord, you kind of think, well, what could those stand in for? Well, I mean, what were the issues of the day? Starvation, famine, corruption. And I think that in a lot of ways, those are really represented. I mean, you look at Smaug, the dragon from The Hobbit. He sits on top of a big pile of gold. What could that represent?
Yeah, no monarchy here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And likewise, Sauron, or any of the sort of Sauron-like enemies, is always this kind of big faceless thing that rules through power and fear. And again, like I think that sort of fits in with the threats at the time, which were this idea of big faceless monsters who rule you from afar. So, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with how we extend the metaphor, how we extrapolize what are these threats in reality.
Yeah. Again, I can see that. And actually, you know, it tends to be, again, more in science fiction, I think, than in fantasy, is fear, you know, that will we be dehumanized? Will the world become a wasteland? Will there be... And these are our ethical dilemmas. but they seem to be far more, how can I change the world, right? And it's external. It's about the world. Whereas the moral dilemmas you get with fantasy fiction is that it's, how can I change myself? Mm-hmm. I cannot fight a dragon, but how will I react to oppression? Yeah. How will I resist temptation? You know, so they're much, again, I think much more internalized in fantasy fiction than in science fiction.
Well, I think that one of the very visceral examples of that, you know, you can look at something like Alien, and obviously I think most people have seen Alien, so they know the thing about the alien bursting out of the chest.
Spoiler alert!
Yeah. I think that's a really good example of our sort of fear of biology, our fear of things inside of us, of our own...
Fear of change.
Yeah. I mean, just the fear of... I mean, granted, we don't like seeing blood and guts, but I mean, our sort of fear of the idea of, like, disease, of filth, of contamination, of being changed from the inside out, that's a really sort of visceral, I think, fear that humans have. And I also think, like, Aliens came out in the 70s, I believe, and, you know, around that time, we were starting to see some really horrible diseases, things that we didn't understand in science, and that reflected in our culture, in our art.
Well, and there was also at the time very much the idea that we would be traveling amongst the stars, and who knows what's out there. I mean, in reality, most people knew even back then that we would not be going to Alpha Centauri or anything like that, but, I mean, you had the space shuttle, you had people still remember people landing on the moon. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like a, you know, hey, what is going to happen when we get to this point and we meet the thing, when we meet our Borg, essentially, our Borg moment. I'm going to pause again for a little break. I'm going to do one more quick commercial. Then we'll come back and we'll talk a bit more about this if we have more to say. But before I do that, you know, you really need to get in touch with your inner fiction, your inner fantasy. And you know what our fantasy is? Our fantasy is to have a nice studio. We want new equipment. We want to be able to continue to provide you with this excellent, excellent commentary. The research that we do for our shows, the subjects that we bring up, the discussions, help enlighten the people, our listeners, at least we hope it does. And it adds a unique voice that you just don't find anywhere else really in radio. It's such a rare thing to have. And it's all made possible by public supported, by you, radio stations like this that can sit there and they can go out and they don't have to worry. Is this particular program going to offend any particular sponsor? Is this program going to, you know, be too risky for our shareholders? No, they don't have to worry about that. The only people they're responsible for, they're accountable to, is you, the listeners, and you right now have your opportunity to stand up and say, yes, this is worthy, this is value, I want to keep this kind of programming on the air. How do you do that? You call 604-822-8648 or go to citr.ca and you donate right now. Ethan, what does this station mean to you?
Well, I think the most important thing here, and you touched on it, is the independent radio. There is, in my opinion, no other place you can go to find this kind of content. Whether you like hard-hitting, controversial topics like Radio Free Thinker, or if you're interested in independent music, or just not hearing the same goddamn song every 5 minutes, you tune to CITR, and there's so much great content here, and there's so much great future content coming. You talked about the movie to the new Student Union building, the future episodes of shows, the enhanced capabilities that we're going to have. It's really exciting, and we need listener support because, again, we don't air beer commercials. We don't air commercials for Viagra. We don't have big checks coming in from record labels to play, you know, Led Zeppelin 9 times every 15 seconds. So we need your support. And again, call in, help us out. We really, really appreciate it.
And on that note, we'll go be back after this.
Oh my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
The Baker and the Chef, Bangone T-Shirts, Cherry Bomb, House of Vintage, Beat Street Records, Dunleavy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, His Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save on Meats, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus. Go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
And we're back. So, Ethan, we were talking a bit about fiction and fantasy. And, you know, there's another aspect to it that I was thinking of again, over the break, is the historicity that is innate in fiction. That not only, how do I put this? You know, in our history, we had big armies with swords and that battling each other. And how does that play in, do you think, to the difference between the sort of much more finite possibilities of the past versus literally the infinite number of possibilities in the future?
Well, I think that there is a separate sort of genre of sort of historical fiction that does kind of take place with limited resources in terms of the past. You know, they pick their time zone, whether it's ancient Rome or the Crusades or whatever, and that's what they kind of work within. But, I mean, with fantasy, you can always just do what Tolkien did, just invent a new world. There's really no limit with magic. That's the interesting thing about magic, is that you can just invent it, and it doesn't even have to make sense. It can just be there.
I think one of the best examples of trying to make science fiction in fantasy is the Discworld series. And if you read the Discworld, you know, they have instamatic cameras in, like, the Tolkien-type era, but they get around it by using little pixies that paint really fast in the camera. And,
yeah,
you know, they do a lot of this stuff by just sort of reinventing it. And again, that says, is it fiction or is it science fiction or is it fantasy when you get this kind of weird morphing?
Well, it's an interesting blend. And it's useful, I think, for us to consider because, you know, we often are struck by our own technology. You know, I just got recently a robot vacuum. And this thing, as far as I'm concerned, is magic. It figures out how to clean your house for you. That's unbelievable. How does it do that? I don't know. I'm sure there's somewhere, there's like a wizard, like conjuring these things out of a jar or something. Because, I mean, it's too fantastical. You know, you look at some of the technology that we have, some of the things. This Oculus Rift thing. Have you seen this? This, like, 3D video game thing. We are really pushing the boundaries. And what's fascinating is how we're extending ourselves. You know, with some of this technology, we're practically being in two places at once. I can be at work and call up my vacuum on my phone and be like, clean my house, vacuum. It'll be like, okay, and I'll fix you a drink too. And it's just, this sort of thing is happening.
So, it's very, very good, Ethan, and we thank you for those comments. But I have to ask you the hard question now. But what the hell does it have to do with skepticism?
Well, I think that skeptics, we can get over-focused on what is or not. You know, we get into these heated debates about homeopathy or Bigfoot or UFOs, and that's all fine and good. But we often sort of forget the philosophical aspect of this. That is, why is science important to us? And, you know, this is something that the new TV series, the new Cosmos TV series, hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson, that's one of the themes that they're talking about, is why do we need to know the science behind how things work? Why do we need to be aware of these sort of things in our lives? And I think it ties directly into the same reason why people pick up Lord of the Rings and the Millions, is because they're looking for a deeper understanding of what makes them human. And science is such a great tool for that. It provides answers, but it also allows us to speculate and to foreshadow the future. I mean, right now, we're talking about this Oculus Rift thing, this video game console that you wear on your face. It's like Google Glass, you know, or even Google Glass is an example. The next step beyond this could be integrating technology with our bodies, like biologically. These are questions that are going to come up. And I think in this day and age, people are going to look at this sort of thing and go, wow, this is kind of scary. How do I deal with this? And if we don't have a science in place to reassure people, to educate them, they're going to turn to things like religion and spiritualism and hocus pocus.
Well, actually, I think you've hit upon, I think, where the idea of fantasy fiction and science fiction in particular are very prevalent in the skeptic community, as opposed to horror fiction, detective fiction, romance fiction, which are all various genres, is these two in particular create what you would call counterfactuals. What if the world was slightly different? How would things react? And essentially, that's the heart of an experiment, right? I mean, these are obviously completely non-real ones. It's a thought experiment at best. But you can go down the road and you can say, well, to use alternative history, which I guess is not, I'm not sure where that fits in ours, but what if Hitler had won the war, right? And then you can kind of do these thought experiments. And I think skeptics in general like the idea of the whole taking things and prying it apart and reassembling it in a slightly different way just for the joy of trying to discover something that you might have missed the first time around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. I think exactly why that so many of these books get reread, people don't put them down, is because they want to... There's always some new layer to uncover, and that's something that I do think is kind of unique with skeptics. I think that there may even be a little bit of an obsessive... quality to us skeptics, that we want to sort of overanalyze things. But again, overanalyzing is not a bad thing. I mean, as long as you do it in moderation, it doesn't hurt to think. It doesn't hurt to carefully reconsider a position. That's always something that we should be doing. And I would point out, I mean, one of the reasons why I felt that my time with the skeptic community was nearing its end was because I thought that we weren't making that option available, that we were getting too sure of ourselves, that we were not considering the option that maybe we should reevaluate our positions on things. And I think that for me, that was one of the things that pointed me in a different direction.
Well, Ethan, I'm not sure if we have more to say about this. Do you have any more on this topic? Because I was going to shift gears a little bit to Bill Nye.
Bill Nye?
Yes.
Well, I always like to talk about Bill Nye.
So, recently there has been infamously the big creationist debate in the States between Bill Nye and Ken Ham of the Creationist Museum. And I thought I'd play a little clip about what they heard when they did this debate and what we heard. So here is, I guess, the creationist version. A little 3-minute quick, this is what happened. Okay, maybe not. Actually, Ethan, what was your take on it? Well, I see if I can figure out my technical issue.
Well, I actually didn't watch the debate. I've seen enough of them to sort of kind of lose interest in that kind of aspect of the sort of debate format thing. I heard from all accounts that Bill Nye resoundingly won. He trampled over Ken Ham with science, and it was amazing to watch. Now, the flip side, of course, is that was a major fundraising effort for the Creation Museum, and not only did they succeed in that respect, they've created a huge windfall, they've gotten a whole lot of publicity. It's a huge benefit to them. So, you know, the question is, well, Mr. Bill Nye, why would you put yourself in the position to allow the Creation Museum, which is basically lying to people, just to be clear, that they are lying to people, give them a windfall of money and all this free publicity, and it's just, you know, like, it's a big debate.
Okay, I think I figured it out.
Okay.
So this is again, a summary of what creationists would have heard at the debate.
Let's welcome our debaters, Mr. Bill Nye and Mr. Ken Ham.
Mr. Ham and his followers have this remarkable view of a worldwide flood that somehow influenced everything that we observe in nature. A 500-foot wooden boat, 8 zookeepers for 14,000 individual animals. I ask us all, is that really reasonable?
We're not saying God created all those species. We're saying God created kinds. And we're not saying species got on the ark, we're saying kinds. In fact, we've had researchers working on what is a kind. For instance, there's a number of papers published on our website. They have predicted probably less than actually 1,000 kinds were on Noah's ark. which means just over 2,000 animals, and the average size of a land animal is not that big. So, you know, there was plenty of room on the ark. When you add up all those genealogies specifically given in the Bible, yeah, from Adam to Abraham, you've got 2,000 years from Abraham to Christ, 2,000 years from Christ to the present, 2,000 years. That's how we get 6,000 years.
If we go to California, we find enormous stands of bristlecone pines. Some of them are over 6,000 years old, 6,800 years old. How could these trees be there if there was an enormous flood just 4,000 years ago?
How did the atoms that created the Big Bang get there?
This is the great mystery. You've hit the nail on the head. No, this is so, what was before the Big Bang? This is what drives us. This is what we want to know. Let's keep looking. Let's keep searching. Nobody knows why. Nobody knows why. To us, this is wonderful and charming and compelling. This is what makes us get up and go to work every day, is to try to solve the mysteries of the universe.
And that's time. Mr. Hamm, a response?
Hey, Bill, I just want to let you know that there actually is a book out there that actually tells us where matter came from. And the very first sentence in that book says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And really, that's the only thing that makes sense. It's the only thing that makes sense of why not just matter is here, where it came from, but why matter, when you look at it, we have information and language systems that build life, not just matter.
How did consciousness come from matter?
Don't know. This is a great mystery. But the joy of discovery, that's what drives us. The joy of finding out what's going on. So we don't know where consciousness comes from, but we want to find out. Furthermore, I'll tell you, it's deep within us. The nature of consciousness is a mystery. I challenge the young people here to investigate that very question.
Bill, I do want to say that there is a book out there that does document where consciousness came from. And in that book, the one who created us said that he made man in his image and he breathed into man and he became a living being. And so the Bible does document that. That's where consciousness...
So that was what creationists heard, and this is what me and Ethan probably heard.
Mr. Hamm, a new question. This is a simple question, I suppose, but one that actually is fairly profound for all of us in our lives. What, if anything... would ever change your mind?
Well, the answer to that question is, I'm a Christian. And as a Christian, I can't prove it to you, but God has definitely shown me very clearly through his word and shown himself in the person of Jesus Christ. The Bible is the Word of God. I admit that that's where I start from. I can challenge people that you can go and test that. You can make predictions based on that. You can check the prophecies in the Bible. You can check the statements in Genesis. You can check that. And I did a little bit of that tonight. And I can't ultimately prove that to you. All I can do is to say to someone, look, if the Bible really is what it claims to be, if it really is the Word of God and that's what it claims, then check it out. And the Bible says if you come to God believing that he is, he'll reveal himself to you, and you will know. As Christians, we can say we know. And so as far as the Word of God is concerned, no one's ever going to convince me that that the Word of God is not true. But I do want to make a distinction here, and for Bill's sake, we build models based upon the Bible, and those models are always subject to change. The fact of Noah's flood is not subject to change. The model of how the flood occurred is subject to change because we observe in the current world and we're able to come up with maybe different ways this could have happened or that could have happened, and that's part of that scientific discovery. That's part of what it's all about. So the bottom line is that as a Christian, I have a foundation. But as a Christian, I would ask Bill the question, what would change your mind? I mean, you said even if you came to faith, you'd never give up believing in billions of years. I think I quoted you correctly. You said something like that recently. So that would be also my question to Bill.
Time. Mr. Nye?
We would just need one piece of evidence. We would need the fossil that swam from one layer to another. We would need evidence that the universe is not expanding. We would need evidence that the stars appear to be far away, but they're not. We would need evidence that rock layers can somehow form in just 4,000 years instead of the extraordinary amount. We would need evidence that somehow you can reset atomic clocks and keep neutrons from becoming protons. You bring on any of those things, and you would change me immediately. The question I have for you, though, fundamentally, and for everybody watching, Mr. Hamm, what can you prove? What you have done tonight is spent most of all the time coming up with explanations about the past. What can you really predict? What can you really prove in a conventional scientific or in a conventional I have an idea that makes a prediction and it comes out the way I see it?
So pretty much preaching to the crowd.
Well, pretty much.
But you know, when I first heard that he was going to do this debate, like you, I was sitting there saying, "Really? Are you going to like sort of promote this sort of idea?" But then I've always said that we need to do pushback. You know, as there's a full spectrum atheist, full spectrum. But yeah, when I heard the whole bit about this publicity stunt allowed them to finish their funding for their Noah Ark sort of project, it just leads in. So, do you think then basically Bill and I was stupid to do this?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, because Bill Nye is a celebrity. He's got more than any other skeptic, you know, maybe next to Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's got a public image as the science guy. If Ken Ham had debated P.Z. Myers or Steve Novella or, I don't know, someone else, who cares? Like, it's some guy who has a podcast. It's some guy who has a pretty cool blog. It's not the same as debating the science guy.
Yeah.
His name is Bill Nye, the science guy. Like, so in that point of view, I wouldn't say that Bill Nye is stupid. I would just say that Bill Nye should really carefully think about, I have a public persona. And again, not to, I don't mean to, you know, call Bill out on this, but he's also a guy who charges, you know, a lot of money for public speaking. He makes his living this way. He should know what will happen if he gives a talk and the organizer gets to keep the prize. I don't know if that's what happened or not. But, I mean, this is what I'm saying, though. He is a public persona. It's like when, you know, a big band does a concert for a dictator. Yeah, maybe you make $2 million and you donate it all to charity. Good for you. But do you want that process to happen?
Well, that was one of the other criticisms that came out that I thought was quite interesting. Is Bill Nye, unlike Neil deGrasse Tyson, unlike Lawrence Krauss and others, he isn't actually a scientist. I mean, he's not. He's an educator.
Yeah.
He is a public media personality. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not selling him just because
he was a scientist in his early career.
Right. But, I mean, he's not known as a scientist per se, but he's a popularist of scientists.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that I thought people had hopes for, is that because his main trade isn't so much the science but the popularization of science, that he's an entertainer, mm-hmm. that he might have been able to turn this turd into gold, if you so to speak. And that he kind of failed in that. That is actually above and beyond the fact that, although, yes, he had a winning argument, his performance wasn't really that good at trying to wow an audience.
Well, I think that he did as good a job as I think anyone could really expect to. I think that these debates, I mean, and I think the evidence is fairly clear that this sort of debate usually only cements opinions. It doesn't necessarily change anyone's mind. It may get like 1% who are sort of on the fence. I never really bought into that. But, you know, if Bill Nye is going to debate Ken Ham, that's going to be big news. And it was. It was all over BuzzFeed. It was all over Twitter. Lots of people saw it. There was memes that followed it around. And, you know, some of it is good. Some of it is good skeptical content, and that's good for Bill, and that's good for skeptics. But at the same time, you're also publicizing creationism. You're publicizing a pretty dangerous lie, you know? And some people will kind of scoff at that, but I really do think that creationism is a pretty dangerous lie. And that's risky. I mean, if Steven Pinker, who's not a historian, but he's known for history, or Michael Shermer, who, again, not famous, but known for history, decided to debate a well-known Holocaust denier, I think we wouldn't be having the same kind of conversation. We'd be sort of like, what WTF, Michael Shermer, right? Like, so, you know, it's kind of a big deal. You know, if Dr. Oz is a terrible example, but someone who was famous as Dr. Oz debated an AIDS denialist, again, we'd be like, what's going on here? This is not right. So, you know, on some level, you kind of have to say to Bill Nye, to the other scientists who do this, are you prepared to deal with this?
Well, do you think then this was sort of like the nail in the coffin, that this was sort of the best possible hope that we could somehow turn this bad thing into a good thing, i.e. debating creationists, was using this popular, very charismatic, very entertaining individual, and he failed at this job. We've had other debates before, so that this will be the end of creationist scientist debates, with the possible exception of, hey, if they want to call me in and offer me $2 million.
I don't think that he would have had that view. I think that the pro-science skeptic side of this argument probably would have been along the lines of...
No, I don't mean what would have been. I mean now. The debate is done.
Right.
And it's like, okay, we've tried it every possible way now that we can think of, and it works out to be crap for us. So this will be the end of any big sort of...
I think that, we're sort of talking about it from the point of view of, like, solving a problem, which the debate will never... I mean, debate in itself is good, but this sort of public debate will never solve a creation-evolution debate. From the point of view as like a group organizer, it's great because it brings people in. You will get a lot of publicity from it. You will get a lot of connection to potential donors, new members, supporters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's great. And from that point of view, fantastic. But keep in mind, though, who you're bringing in, who's going to be speaking on your behalf, and, you know, what you honestly expect to get out of it shouldn't be to change the world. If that's what Bill thought, then he was really in the wrong place, because the best that he could hope for would be to be talking on behalf of a skeptical organization, a CFI, a JRF, whatever, and say, listen, if you like this sort of thing, donate to us, help us promote science and science literacy, and we'll make the world a better place. But just going out there and saying, hey, I'm a science guy and I'm going to debate this, that doesn't help. All you're doing is giving a lot of resources to whoever organized the event.
So what about then if Bill Nye was going to go debate a climate denialist? Would that be sort of a similar event?
Well, again, you run the risk of putting that climate denialist on the same level as Bill Nye the science guy. You know, and we can debate what level Bill Nye the science guy is really at, but if you're prepared to make that risk... And some people are. Some people should be prepared to take that risk because there's some really good debaters. Christopher Hitchens, for example, was a master at this sort of thing. And some people can take that situation and be like, yeah, bring it on, because I'm going to get CFI to host it. They're going to book a space. They're probably going to get like $4,000 in donations from the event alone. They're going to raise their profile. And some crazy climate change denialist is probably going to get, you know, a few more emails on his newsletter. But the world's not going to change.
So then, again, I think maybe you'll see now with my next question where this is going to go. So what about someone who wants to debate whether we should go for nuclear power or not? Like, you see there's a slope that we're going down.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's slippery.
But again, like, even if, say, David Suzuki, who is a pretty well-known Canadian scientist who's kind of a bit kooky in certain areas, nuclear power being one of them, debated, I don't know, someone who's in favor of nuclear power. Again, like, put it in a neutral place like UBC, and they're just hosting it for the free exchange of ideas, that sort of thing. UBC will have a great time hosting it. They'll get lots of donations. It'll be looked at on their campus. But is it going to change anyone's mind? Probably not. If you're willing to pay money to go see that debate, you want to see your side win.
Right.
You're not there to be convinced by the other side, you know. So it's going to be a tricky thing. And again, like, I'm not saying that it should never be done or that it's always going to be bad.
It sounds like that's what you're saying.
Well, I should.
You're saying that, hey, okay, it has the good point of bringing out the troops and perhaps increasing funding, but the debate itself are really just pointless. Why really bother having?
Well, I shouldn't make the point like that. I mean, if that is the way it's coming across, perhaps I'm being too pessimistic. But I think you have to be very careful. I think that there really is a ethical side to this sort of thing of publicizing a fringe view or a potentially dangerous view.
Yeah, but how do you make that call that it's a fringe view versus a not fringe view?
Yeah.
I mean, because like I say, I think we creationism, definitely nuts. Climate science denialists, not quite as impossible as creation, but still pretty much nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Nuclear power, maybe there is a debate there, you know? So, I mean, like how do you...
I think that the key factor is going to depend on what the two sides want to get out of it. I think that the sort of debate where you are trying to convince people of something, which is typically most skeptic debates are sort of structured that way. I'm here to convince you that evolution is true. I'm here to convince you that climate science is showing that humans are causing global warming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those don't necessarily float my boat. I'm skeptical that those have a net benefit. I think debates that are a bit more open-ended in structure, like let's discuss the value of open source science or something like that, you know, something where two reasonable people could disagree with, reasonable being the operative word there, that's, I think, valuable. That's interesting to me because there you could have someone walk in and go, huh, I never really looked at it from that point of view before. And it's not necessarily you're there to like hammer a point into someone's head. You're there to sort of like provide alternative explanations.
So maybe there you have one of the criteria or crux of the matter is that, and this is going to sound a little off, but hopefully I'll fix it up, is that you can't really debate science. Science is, by and large, facts and proofs and evidence, and you can't really debate those ideas. You may argue about them. You know, you may provide new evidence to promote your side, but there isn't a, I'm going to believe in gravity today and I won't believe it tomorrow sort of moment. But if you move into something like the social sciences, like, you know, should science be made available to everybody, isn't so much a scientific question. It's a values question. What's mm-hmm. good for society? Should we invade the Ukraine? You know, that's not a science question. There you can kind of have, well, I hate to use the word ethical debate, but I mean, there isn't a sort of hard, cold fact that's at the end of it. And there's mm-hmm. there is the point of persuasion. Any final thoughts on that?
Well, no, I think that really sort of sums it up quite well.
Oh, good. So before we end the show, we're obviously going to go out by saying, do you know how much this hour cost? It cost the station $28, which doesn't sound like much. But when you factor in that this show alone in a year is over $2,000, and we need $2,000 to keep the show running, can you please at least donate $28 for this hour? CITR offers you great value. Radio Free Thinker offers you great value. We need you to call in. We need you to donate. Give whatever you can. If it's $5, it's great. If it's $500, even better. But every little penny counts towards keeping independent, free news, entertainment radio such as CITR open. So you can call it 604-822-8648 or go to the website. Ethan, do you have any final comments?
Yeah, just finally to all those listeners out there, do consider donating. I know that it's everyone has bills to pay and things to get on with, but you know what? Even a cup of coffee is $5. And I mean, all of us could go without one extra cup of coffee a day.
At least one.
One, just at least one.
Okay, maybe not the morning coffee.
But
the one you have in the afternoon, skip that and just give what you can. It really, really makes a difference, not only in your life as the person who's donating, but for the hundreds and thousands, and we can dream millions of people who listen who can't afford anything, because some people literally are poverty, and it lets it be free for everyone so everyone can enjoy this. Make a difference in your community. Get on the phone. Donate now. 604-822-8648. 8648 or CITR.ca. I guess this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan saying nice to be back and see you later.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.